Good afternoon, and welcome to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg, and we're live from 2 to 3 in the afternoon Pacific time, as we generally are, Monday through Friday. This is Friday, of course, the end of our broadcast week, and therefore the last opportunity for me to speak with you and you to me and our audience before the weekend. If you have questions about the Bible or about the Christian faith or about the Christian life and would like to ask those here, we can talk about them here. We don't know all the answers, at least I don't, but at least this is one place where no one is afraid to have you ask. And so if you have questions that have always bothered you, perplexed you about the Bible, about God, about Jesus, about Christian beliefs or practices, whether you're coming from the Christian side of the aisle or the non-Christian side of the aisle, you're welcome to be a part of the show. Also, if you disagree with the host about something that's been said or will be said on this program, feel free to give me a call. The number is 1-800-438-5090. Right now, all of our lines are open, very strange, and so it's a good time for you to break on through ahead of the rest at 1-800-438-5090. That's 1-800-438-5090. Bert wrote and said, "Even if you could prove that there is a God, how could you know whether the real God is the God of Christianity or the God of some other religion?" Well, that's obviously one of the questions that we would have to ask once we've asked ourselves, is there reason to believe there is a God? And that is an exploration some people have never made a serious attempt to discover. Certainly would be the first thing to discover, is there a God? Is there evidence that there is a God? The second question would be, which God? Is it the God of Christianity or the God of some other religion? This is where you'd have to look at the evidence of the different religions and see what they say. On what are the truth claims of the other religions? Insofar as I've been able to compare religious truth claims of various religions, I consider that Christianity has the most credible evidence of its claims that God has revealed himself to certain persons. He revealed himself to the prophets in the Old Testament, to Moses and the prophets. He revealed himself in the time of the first century through Jesus Christ to the disciples who reported what they saw and what they heard. And so in the Bible, which is written by those prophets and by those apostles, we have the record of God's revelation of himself. It is that revelation that would give us confidence in knowing that we have something from God that tells us which God he is. Now, of course, people would say, well, but don't the other religions have holy books too? Well, yes, they do for the most part. Many of them do have holy books. So what? The question is, which gives evidence of being a true revelation from God? The Bible certainly does. For one thing, the Bible has historical events throughout that can be verified by other historical records. That's helpful. Another thing that the Bible has is the phenomenon of prophecy that is fulfilled, which God himself calls upon as the witness that it is truly his word and not man's, since man cannot predict the future. And God continuously in the Old Testament would predict the future through the prophets to demonstrate that the prophets were who they said they were, messengers from God. And, of course, most of all, we have the resurrection of Christ, a historically verifiable event with many witnesses and has as much historical evidence in its favor as virtually most ancient historical things do. And once again, of course, there's also the possibility of getting to know this God personally and having him act in your life and be a part of your life. I mentioned that last, not because it's the least important, but because it's the most subjective. And when you have merely subjective things to go on, then you have to deal with the fact that other religions have a subjective phenomena also. Many people of other religions think that their God is active in their life. But, of course, our faith tells us that there's not only God, but there's also demonic powers who can counterfeit the things of God. And therefore, it does not surprise us that people of other religions might have experiences which they think are from God. They don't have the means of discerning between the true and the counterfeit, which we have through the scriptures and through and through, of course, the revelation given in Christ. So that would be how I would know that the God that exists is not simply, a God of some nebulous, amorphous, nondescript sort, or the specific God of some other religion, but that the God that made us all is the God who revealed himself in Jesus Christ and in the Scriptures. So that's how we would know. It's a good question, and people should be asking that question, and they should be seeking the answer too. Let's talk to Mario from Salinas, California, first of all. Hi, Mario. Welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hey, Steve. How you doing?
Good.
Listen, I have a question, or I want to see what your thoughts are. I came through the Jesus movement back in the early 70s.
Yes.
And the way the churches operate today, I want to find out what your take is on how so many churches are operating more like corporate America than it was back in the late 60s and early 70s through the Jesus movement. Even the Assemblies of God operate differently now, more like the Catholicism system is set up. When the Pope speaks, it's like God speaks to all the Catholic churches throughout the world. So whatever he says, it goes to all the churches, wherever they may be. Now, there are some ministries out there that operate in the same fashion. What's your opinion on churches operating like that?
Well, it sounds like the first part of your question was, how could it be that there would be something as spiritual and non-institutional as the
right.
Jesus movement back in the early 70s, and now the churches are operating like corporations and like institutions instead? There's
right.
two ways of looking at that. It is a phenomenon that is common in history, that there would be a revival, which is a truly spiritual movement, and then after a generation, it simply becomes cemented into an institutional phenomenon. Some people refer to this as embalming the revival, or embalming.
A generation, we find that's a 40-year span.
Pardon?
A generation is a 40-year span.
Well, I'm not thinking in terms of 40 years specifically. I'm just saying that there's another generation that comes up who never saw the revival, but insofar as the movement continues, it tends to get continued in an organized form instead of in a spontaneous revivalistic form. Now, some people think that's inevitable and good. Some people think that a revival is just there to spark something, but it's disorganized. It's not orderly. It's something that has to be tamed. It has to be fenced in. It has to be defined codified.
Doesn't that have its downfall also after it becomes institutionalized?
I think so. Yeah, I'm not in favor of institutionalizing it. It's human nature to institutionalize it. See, what it is a revival cannot be controlled by man. A revival is a spontaneous thing. It comes as a result of people praying and repenting and so forth. But even if you pray and repent, you can't make a revival happen. God will send a revival when he wants it to happen and when he chooses. And so when a revival happens, it's entirely a work of God. And people can't control the work of God. And when God stops doing the revival in the same manner as before, people often want to continue it by organizing it.
Isn't that what happened in the Azusa Street revival?
I think so. I think it happened even in the early church after the first century. It seems like the revival of the first century got institutionalized in the second and third and fourth centuries. And I think that happens a lot. It's not a good thing, but it's human nature to want to control it, to organize it, to perpetuate it with or without a continuing move from God.
Right. Now, so I won't take up too much time, one last question. What's your opinion on a ministry who has various churches throughout America or the world, and they are required to pay tithes to the corporate church?
Well, I don't think there's anything spiritual about a movement that requires a certain amount of money to be paid to them. I believe that spiritual movements, as Paul put it, he says, we minister to you in spiritual things, it's no big thing for you to minister to us in material things. What he said, what he means is that it should be a spontaneous thing. If you're receiving spiritual benefit from somebody, then it's not a strange thing. In fact, it's a normal thing for that person to receive their physical support from you.
Right.
But if it's not spiritual, then they have to demand money, you see. If there's really a move of the Spirit of God going on, if people are really getting fed, they don't mind supporting it because they want the source of feeding to continue to be available. It's like if you go to a restaurant and they give you good food, you don't object to paying the tab and putting a tip on there if the service is good. I mean, that's just something we're accustomed to. Likewise, when we're fed spiritually, we naturally want to support and continue the availability of that which is ministering to us. But when it's not spiritual, then the organization has to start, sending you a bill and saying, you have to pay us even though you don't want to.
Well, that's the way it happened in the Jesus movement, where we were willing to give because we were being fed and, the love of God was shed abroad in our hearts. And we willingly gave out of that love.
Yep.
But today, it's like, they put a burden on you to either you give your 10% or you're guilty of robbing God.
Well, they're taking Malachi chapter 3 and verse 10 is their key there. But Malachi is not written to Christians. It's written to Jews who were obligated to give their tithes to the Levites. There's nothing in the Bible that says that Christians are supposed to give their tithe to anybody in particular.
Right. Anyway, that was my question.
So,
I appreciate
right. So,
the time.
when it's the Spirit of God doing something, people do things out of love. When the Spirit of God's not moving, then they have to be made to do it by laws.
But they can manipulate and manufacture or try anyway an atmosphere to make it look like a move of the Spirit.
That's true. It can be faked, yeah.
Because that's happening a lot today.
Right. But you and I have seen the real thing before. And
We know the difference. But anyway, I thank you for your time, Steve. I'm going to have the callers.
Okay, Mario. Good talking to you. God bless you. Bye now. Okay, our next caller is John from Hillsboro, Oregon. John, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Steve. Are you there?
Yes.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm in Exodus chapter 16 where it mentions quail.
Yep.
It says something like the quail came down and covered the earth and then the manna came.
Uh-huh.
And then I was in Numbers, I think it's 11, where it gives a full detail of the people, complaining for meat and then the quail coming down.
Uh-huh.
And I'm wondering, are those two separate incidents?
Yes, I believe so. I believe they are separate incidents. Yeah, one happened when they had first come out of Egypt and before they got to Mount Sinai. God provided quail and manna for them. He continued to provide manna on a daily basis, but he didn't continue to provide quail on a daily basis. So they went long periods of time without eating meat. They ate manna on a daily basis, but the quail was a special treat, in addition to their diet, and it happened more than once. Yeah, once it happened in chapter 11 of Numbers, and once in chapter 16 of Exodus.
So the reason that I found this kind of interesting is I'm doing a study on tithing, and I get into Moses and the law, and the people complain for meat, and I'm wondering, why don't they just eat one of their other nine if they're tithing?
Their other nine what?
Well, they have to tithe bulls and goats, right?
Well, yes. They have to give a tithe of everything, but the bulls and the goats were, they did have livestock, but they didn't want to kill off their livestock. They needed them for breeding stock. They didn't have enough livestock to eat them on a regular basis. They were moving all the time, uh-huh. And so they weren't ranching. They weren't increasing their livestock, in a regular fashion. They, I mean, they're obviously the livestock would do some breeding, But with the number of people they had and the number of sacrifices they had to offer, they could easily eat up all their livestock, I'm sure, within a few days or weeks. And that would have been disastrous because they wouldn't then have any breeding stock when they came into the Promised Land. So I'm sure that from time to time they did eat it. Actually, when they brought sacrifices to the tabernacle, a portion of the sacrifice was eaten by them as well. So they had some meat occasionally.
Okay. Well, this kind of makes the livestock then become more... More sacred or something.
How so?
Well, because if they eat them, they'll become extinct or whatever.
Yeah, well, I'm not sure that makes them more sacred. It might make them more rare and more precious. Yeah.
More precious.
More valuable. Yeah.
That's a better word. Okay, thank you. I was just wondering, I had one person tell me that there's a chronological problem because the law had not been given yet.
At what point? In chapter 16?
No, in Numbers.
Well, the law had been given in Numbers. In Numbers, the law had been given.
Yeah. Yeah, then I found the mention of it in Exodus 16, and it kind of threw me off. That's why I asked, so thank you.
Yeah, I believe there are two different times that quail were sent.
Okay. You have a great day.
Okay, John. Thanks for your call. Let's talk to Walt from Kaiser, Oregon again. And good to hear from you yesterday, Walt. Good to hear from you again today. Welcome.
Hi, Steve. Thanks. Sorry to call so often here, but I have a couple more follow-up questions. And one is in regard to a gentleman who called a few minutes after I spoke with you, and he gave you some figures that I'm just questioning. I'm just wondering. He said something about the church in Ishmael. Sounds like he said 20,000 in the church there. Did I hear incorrectly?
He did quote some kind of a large number, and I don't remember how much. Yeah, it was a surprisingly large number he gave.
And that was not just in the city, but the church itself. He was talking about.
That's what I understood him to be saying. Yeah, I don't know what size Izmir is. I've never been there, and I have I don't know very much about the Turkish cities, or frankly, the Turkish church. But it sounded like a very large number that they would have, if that's true. Of course, there could be large congregations of Greek Orthodox or Eastern Orthodox in Turkey, and there might be that many in a diocese.
And I thought he mentioned, and maybe this was in regards to the Philadelphia church, he said something about two churches. He said something about a family that was overseeing that church there, and one was Armenian, and I don't know what the other one was. Do you understand what he was saying there?
Well, I understood him to say that although the city of Philadelphia is in ruins, there is a place near Philadelphia, where where there's a Christian family maintaining worship or something like that. He gave a lot of details that I didn't retain because he was talking about lots of different details of the churches there in Turkey. But it's probably something you could look up online. I've never done so.
Okay, I haven't either. You mentioned the Armenian church. Is that particular, like a denomination, or
well, Armenian is a race, a nationality of people.
Okay.
He's not referring to Armenian, as in the opposite of Calvinist.
I didn't think he was.
Yeah, see, those are two different words that sound almost the same. To say that somebody has Arminian theology, it means that they're followers of Arminius's theology, as opposed to Calvinist theology. But Armenians. I'm not even sure how to pronounce it sufficiently differently to make it distinct. They are a nationality of people who were, for the most part, driven out of Turkey by a ruthless Turkish invasion of their land, I suppose 100 years ago or so. And about half of the Armenian people left Europe and came to America. I think most of them are in Los Angeles area now. But... Yeah, there's It's a racial designation as opposed to a theological designation.
Would you know the other racial church that he mentioned also there?
I don't remember. I don't remember what other race he mentioned there. Okay. Yeah, sorry about that.
Okay, there's one other thing. You mentioned before that the reformers were pretty much amillennialists.
Yes.
Were they also historists as differentiating between, you know?
Right. Yeah. In their view of Revelation, they were historicists. They were not preterists.
Okay.
Nor futurists. They were historicists. That means they believed that the book of Revelation covered the whole age of the church from John's time until the end.
Well,
and therefore, they believed that the beast was the papacy.
Okay. Yeah. I think that clarifies everything there.
All right. Yeah, that was the universal view of all the reformers, and even before the Reformation, even some Roman Catholics held that view. The Franciscans held a view like that, too.
Okay, very good. Thank you, Steve, very much.
All right. And good to talk to you again, Walt.
Thank
God bless you.
Bye.
Bye now. All right, our lines are open once again. And if you'd like to be on the program, give me a call at 1-800-438-5090. We've had quite a few calls come and go in the first half of the program. We have another half to go, about another half hour. So if you'd like to be on, you can take advantage of the open lines we have right now. The number 1-800-438-5090. That's 1-800-438-5090. Susan wrote and said, as I read the New Testament, or as I read the New Testament, I saw that adultery is grounds for divorce. And Jesus said that if a man looks at a woman to lust after her, he has committed adultery in his heart. If a husband or wife is guilty of this mental sin, does this give their spouse grounds for divorce? She says. My answer is that I believe that mental sin is for God to judge, not for us to judge one another. And I don't think we can penalize each other for mental sins merely if it never manifests in any kind of physical behavior. For example, Jesus said that if you're angry at your brother without a cause, it's comparable to murder. Yet we do not believe in capital punishment or even sending people to jail forever just because they had anger towards somebody. If they control their anger and they don't do anything about it, then they shouldn't be punished by the magistrate or by people. Now, God may still hold it against them. God, who sees the heart, also judges the heart. But we're not given the right to judge each other's hearts. Therefore, though a man who looks at a woman to lust after her may be committing adultery in his heart, he's not committing it physically at that point. He might later go and do that as well. But until he does something physical, I don't think that he's doing anything that human beings can penalize each other for. We can't be the thought police of other people. And unfortunately, people commit mental sins all the time. I suppose that if we were to come to the conclusion that a woman could divorce her husband because he had mental lust, then every marriage in Christendom would be in danger of that, because almost all men at one time or another have experienced some kind of a mental lust problem. They fight it. Good men fight it. And, if you're fighting it, then you're on the side of virtue. You're on the side of your marriage. You're on the side of your wife. If you're succumbing to it, then it's going to manifest in behavior. And I would say it's the behavior that becomes grounds for divorce, not the thoughts in the mind. That'd be my understanding. I appreciate that question being asked. Let's talk to Paul from Snohomish, Washington. Paul, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi there.
Hi.
I'm sure you've heard of Mr. Harold Camping. What do you think of his theology and so on?
You mean his theology about the end times, about the end of the world?
Yeah, and also the end of the church age.
Right. Well, I don't think that he has any biblical grounds for his theology, if that's what you're wondering. To say that the church age ended at a particular time and is now over to my mind, would suggest that there's no more church. And that simply isn't true. The church still is here. There still are Christians. The Christians are the church. The body of Christ is here. So the age of the church is not over. And the suggestion that it would be has got to be based on some kind of esoteric abstraction drawn from some misunderstanding of certain passages of Scripture, which Harold Camping is quite good at misunderstanding Scripture, it would appear. And as a result, he has made many predictions that have not come true, making him, I suppose, qualified to be a false prophet. Okay, looks like Paul is one of those kinds of people who leaves the room without saying goodbye. Let's talk to Brad, who's calling from somewhere. I don't know where. Hello, Brad. Welcome.
Hey, howdy. You know, many...
Oh, it's that Brad. Hi, Brad. Good to hear from you. Kuski, Idaho. Yeah.
You know, you always hear that Paul didn't abolish slavery. It seems to me like the only slavery that he didn't abolish was a father selling their child. Seems like all other slavery that was lawful was abolished, especially considering that a man should only have one wife, so therefore he couldn't buy a wife as a slave. What do you think about that?
Well, I'm not sure. You say the only slavery he didn't abolish was a man selling his child?
Right. Of course, now that's taken into consideration that slavery just really means employment, I think. Like indentured servitude is really just employment, it seems to me like. It's not, I mean, if a guy, like when they cross the ocean, they would sell themselves for, you know, several years to the captain for a fare, for the price of the fare.
Uh-huh.
So that seems more like employment. And obviously he wouldn't abolish, you know, the idea of going to work for somebody.
Yeah, I don't actually see Paul, in all the times that he speaks about slavery, I don't see him saying anything that would abolish any kind of slavery necessarily.
Well, like, he wouldn't have to abolish unlawful slavery because it's already unlawful. But I'm talking about lawful slavery. It seems like the only lawful slavery that he didn't apparently abolish would be a father selling their child.
Now, well, that suggests that he did abolish all other kinds of slavery, and I'm just wondering what passages you're thinking of.
Well, you can only be a husband of one wife. That would be, he would abolish the idea of buying a wife.
You know? Right, but I mean, Paul didn't encourage Christians to buy slaves at all. But he didn't forbid it either. When he spoke about slavery, he simply spoke to people who were already involved in the institution. But he wrote to masters who owned slaves, and he wrote to slaves who were already in the institution. He never discussed the morality of going out and buying new slaves or not buying new slaves. So he never really abolished any kind of slavery that I can think of.
I guess the reason why I'm saying that is because I don't think he was. I think his word for slavery is what we would use for employment. What do you think about that? Or am I totally off there?
Well, I think that the word doulos is used in most cases, if I'm not mistaken. And doulos means a slave. I mean, there is the word servant, and there's the word slave. And a slave was a piece of property in the Roman world. Now, Paul was writing to people in the Roman world, so my assumption is that when he used the word slave, he was using the word as it would be used in their society, which would mean somebody who was a piece of property to somebody else, part of the household.
But if you became a Christian, and so therefore you're the new Israel, then I think that the laws of like Hebrew slavery would apply. So from that perspective, Paul wouldn't have to abolish it. All one would have to do is read the Bible to see that unlawful slavery is unlawful.
Well, yeah, the law, if you bought a fellow Hebrew slave, it was more like indentured servitude because he'd have to be released in 7 years if he wished to be. If he didn't wish to be released in 7 years, though, he'd become a slave for life and would not be offered his freedom a second time. Now, that only applied to Hebrew slaves. It was very clear in the law that if you had foreign slaves, you didn't have to offer them their freedom after 7 years. That was a different set of circumstances. Now, what I'm saying is that when Paul wrote to the Romans or to the people of Asia Minor or the Galatians or to the Greeks, whenever he spoke about slavery, he was writing to situations where people already owned slaves. He was not discussing whether someone should buy slaves or not, or whether they should sell themselves into slavery. He's writing with the assumption that some people are slaves. A very large percentage of the Roman population was slaves, and many of them were Christians. And some of them were slave owners who had become Christians. So, I just don't see anything abolishing slavery in any of Paul's writings.
And I'm saying the reason why is because it was already unlawful. That's what I'm saying. I think he didn't have to say that it needs to be abolished because the only lawful slave. Let's say I sell myself to you and you pay my fare, and I sell myself to you for 7 years. That is really employment more than slavery, in our definition.
Right, but most of the slave owners in Rome, for example, probably had slaves that were not indentured. They were probably just part of their estate.
Exactly. So, but he wouldn't have to abolish that because once they became Christians and read the Bible, they would realize, well, I'm involved in something that would be unlawful, it's man stealing or whatever, because most slavery is probably unlawful.
A lot of slaves, I believe, sold themselves into slavery because of financial reasons, and that was not unlawful.
We would call that indentured servitude nowadays. And
but if they could never be released, they're now a slave.
That was the one guy. You know, I only see that once, and you just mentioned that scripture, and it's if he marries, whereas if you tie that in with the same scripture there. If a man sells his daughter, the guy who bought it can never sell her.
So, okay, see, I'm not looking at the Old Testament law about slavery right now. I'm looking at the fact that there was an institution that the Romans practiced throughout the empire, which Paul found in place, and which some Christians were involved in, because they had been in that society involved in it, and they became Christians, and so Paul's instructions to them. Are not assuming anything about the Jewish law about slavery. It's just assuming that there's a social institution that's right there in place and that people are involved in it. Some of the people, if their slaves were not Jewish, there'd be nothing wrong with them keeping them as slaves under the law. You know, I mean, no Christian would consider in the Roman Empire would consider that he was violating the Jewish law if he had a Scythian slave or a barbarian slave or something like that in his
household. But the only way he could have a slave like that lawfully was in a war situation.
Could be. Yeah, it could be a prisoner of war.
I would find another way to get him lawfully other than that.
Purchasing from someone else. Purchasing from someone else.
He could only purchase from the father, from what I can see. Only a father, like a brother, couldn't sell his brother.
No, but the former owner could. The former owner of a slave could sell him.
Exactly. So if I sold myself to a ship captain for 7 years and then 3 years goes by, that ship captain could sell me to somebody else for the remaining 4 years. And so from that perspective, I could see where Paul would not want to try to outlaw that.
I don't see Paul outlawing any form of. That's what I'm saying, Brad. I'm not sure we're getting anywhere in this particular discussion because you're talking about lawful versus unlawful slavery.
Exactly.
According to the law of Moses, and I'm not sure that any of the slavery in the Roman Empire was governed by the law of Moses.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah,
so that's why I'm saying he didn't have to outlaw it. It was already outlawed. That's where I'm coming from.
Okay.
Anyway, well, and so I just want to get your perspective on that, but I guess I don't quite understand it.
Well, I'm not really sure about it, that I understand yours either. But, I mean, mine's very simple. Mine's very simple. Slavery was practiced in all societies until modern times. Every society,
so polygamy.
Not all societies, but polygamy was practiced in many societies. Slavery was practiced in all societies and still is in non-Christian parts of the world. Christianity, the influence of Christianity, caused slavery to be abolished in the Western world. at least legal slavery. There's, of course, illegal slavery still going on.
And I think that's because they studied the Bible and saw that there was very few opportunity of lawful slavery.
Well, I think what they saw was that their slave is their brother, and that the people who were capturing slaves were treating these people, they were kidnapping.
So it was unlawful slavery.
Right. But the point I'm making is they abolished all slavery, even lawful slavery.
No, not necessarily. I can sell myself into slavery right now, lawfully.
Well, but you can't be a slave. You can be an employee, but you can't be owned by somebody else.
And I'm saying it's the same thing. That 2,000 years ago, it's the same thing as what I would do now. Like if I can join the military and get a bonus, and I would have to stay there for 6 years. You can do the same thing with contracts with where it's not military. And if you don't do it, then you're breaking the law. You could actually go to jail for it.
Okay, but my point is that when Paul wrote to slaves and to slave owners, they were in an institution that may or may not have put them in slavery by good means. A man may have sold himself into slavery. His children were born slaves then. His children then could be sold by the owner to another person with or without their consent. This was the way slavery was. They were property.
But that was unlawful, right?
Well, I don't see how it was. What law would forbid it?
Well, they could only do it for 7 years.
No, that's not true. Actually, remember the law in the Old Testament that says if a man has a Hebrew slave and the owner gives that slave a wife and he has children, and the wife and the children belong to the slave owner, and the Hebrew slave could be offered his freedom after 7 years, but if he did take it, he have to leave his wife and his children behind. So,
they belong.
That's lawful. That'd be lawful then for the slave owner to own the children and the wife.
Because that was applied to the law where if a slave owner bought a female, he couldn't ever sell her again.
Well, we got the children in there too. Okay. Anyway, I don't think Brad, on this point, I don't think we're really
connecting. I'm going to have to narrow my question down a little better.
Yeah, I don't understand. See, I'd like to see. It sounds like you're saying there's only one kind of slavery Paul did not abolish. That means he did abolish all other kinds. I'm just curious to know what passage in the Bible Paul abolished any slavery in.
Well, one that I think is pretty clear is a woman. You can only have one wife.
Right, but a slave, you could be a single man and have a slave woman and then marry her. So, I mean, that wouldn't be wrong. Or you could be a married man and have female slaves, but not sleep with them. You know, I mean, that's not the idea of having only one wife is not connected at the hip to slavery.
They would buy their second wife.
Well, some people would, but I mean, but the point is, it's not hard to imagine a Roman household where the owner of the slaves had male and female slaves, but he only had one wife, and the male and female slaves were doing the household work, and that would not be unlawful under Christian.
But I think it would be unlawful in the Bible, though. I mean, for biblical laws, it would be unlawful.
But I guess which laws are we talking about here?
Well, all the moral laws of both testaments. So I think I don't think so.
I think the Old Testament and the New Testament allow the institution of slavery. It's not something that Western civilization can approve of, but all other civilizations in history have approved of it.
I think they only allowed, and I'm going to keep studying it, but I think they only allowed voluntary slavery or a father selling his children. I think it's only those two. But I'll keep studying and call you back.
Well, Paul sent Onesimus back to Philemon.
Because apparently, I mean, it very could have been, he was a volunteer slaver. And plus, they weren't Jews, maybe. But he may have sold himself, and so he had a contract.
Well, okay, well, there's a lot of possibilities there. I don't see any exegetical evidence of that.
I guess what frustrates me is I listen to a lot of post-Civil War Confederate apologists, and it's just so frustrating to me that they'll use things like, well, slavery was never abolished. And my perspective is, well, it didn't need to be abolished. It was all forms of slavery were breaking the moral law except for those two that I can see.
But why would that be? If they're not violating any of the rights of the slave, why would they be breaking the moral law?
Well, because of man-stealing. Because only
man stealing is one thing. That's right. Man stealing is against the law and is a capital crime.
I'm thinking all slavery is man stealing unless you yourself volunteered to be a slave by selling yourself as an indentured servant.
Or your parents had done so and you were born a slave.
Exactly.
Or you were a prisoner of war.
Right, just the prisoner of war one would be, and even that is kind of iffy. I'm going to keep looking at that one. In the Old Testament,
a prisoner of war could be a slave as opposed to a casualty.
Okay, and I knew that, but Christians should not be involved in war, so they wouldn't have the opportunity to have prisoners of war.
No, but Brad, the point I'm making is this. That there, in a society like the Roman society, about 50% of the people there were slaves. Whether they were prisoners of war, whether they'd sold themselves into slavery, whatever condition had brought them into slavery, we'd have to take case by case. But in all likelihood, there was a random sampling of different conditions that had brought people into slavery, and among those who owned slaves were people who became Christians. And we don't find Paul saying, now, if your slave was acquired in such and such a way, you must release it. Although if your slave was acquired in another way, you must not. Paul simply took for granted that slavery was part of Roman society just as it is part of every society.
Well, I guess my perspective is different there. I think that he took for granted that as Christians, they would realize that they would their particular slavery may be wrong and they better do something about it.
Okay.
But anyway. Well, nice talking to you there.
Okay, Brad. Good talking to you. Bye now. Okay, our next caller is Gregory calling from Las Vegas. Hi, Gregory. Welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling me today.
Hello.
Hi.
Sorry, there's static on the phone. So
I can hear an echo, too, but go ahead. We can hear you.
Okay, well, Walt called again today. I forget what he asked. The population of Izmir is 3.5 million or 3.4 million, actually.
Okay.
And so the church there of 20,000 is just what is left over from the long Greek colonization of the Turkish coast, which...
Okay, and he had that other question about the Philadelphian church.
Yeah, he asked nationality, where the old city was, where they built a Christian church, was quite large during the 2nd and 3rd centuries. That is the area that this family is taking care of and maintaining. And they are part of a local evangelical church that is Turkish. I mean, their nationality is Turkish.
Okay.
But they're not Muslim. They're Christian.
Okay. I appreciate that clarification. I know that Walt is probably listening, and it's good to hear that clarified. Let's talk to Tony from M. On my screen, it just says from M. So, Tony, I don't know where you're calling from. Welcome.
Las Vegas.
Oh, from Las Vegas. Okay. Welcome.
Hi, Steve. I have two questions. One, what is the difference between the Antichrist and the Beast? And my second question is, at what time in church history did the church believe that the papacy was either the beast or the Antichrist?
Well, okay, the first question, the difference between the papacy or the Antichrist and the beast. The beast is mentioned only in Revelation chapter 13 and 17, and also a brief mention in chapter 11. And the beast appears to be an entity made up of many governments, because it has 7 heads and 10 horns. Now, the 10 horns are said to be 10 kings, and the 7 heads are also said to be 7 mountains and 7 kings. So we're not just talking about an individual here. Some people think the beast is a man, and they equate it with the Antichrist. That's not a very natural way of looking at it. The beast in Revelation is a composite of the 4 beasts in the book of Daniel. In Daniel, there are 4 beasts that come out of the sea. In Daniel 7, there's one like a lion, one like a bear, one like a leopard, and one that has ten horns. And so we see that the beast in Revelation chapter 13 has a mouth like a lion and feet like a bear, and it's like a leopard, and it has ten horns as well as seven heads. So it's obviously got the features of all four of Daniel's beasts. Now, Daniel's beasts do not refer to individual men. They refer to empires, the Babylonian, the Medo-Persian, the Grecian, and the Roman empires. So it's obvious that the beasts in Daniel are not individual men. They are empires. Now, the beast in Revelation is a combination of all of them, apparently. And it's be a, I think, a tremendous mistake to think that the beast is an individual man. Why would the beast in Revelation be an individual man when the beasts in Daniel, from which its description is borrowed, are not individual men? I think that the beast in Revelation simply represents all governments that persecute the church, and there have been many throughout history, and I think that's what's represented by the beast. But if I'm wrong, at least the beast would not be an individual man. The beast would be a governmental system. Now, the Antichrist is a term that's used only in the book of 1 John and the book of 2 John. You don't find the word Antichrist in any of the prophetic literature in the Bible. Not in the book of Revelation, not in Thessalonians, not in the Olivet Discourse. The term Antichrist is not found in any prophetic book. The word Antichrist is used only in John's first and second epistles. And there he says, whoever denies that Jesus comes in the flesh, this is Antichrist. He says, whoever denies that Jesus is the Christ, he is Antichrist. So John uses the term Antichrist generically. He says, as you have heard that Antichrist is coming, already there are many Antichrists, by which we know it is the final hour, John says. So Antichrist is a generic term for anyone who denies that Jesus is the Christ.
Mm-hmm.
And in a sense, therefore, the term Antichrist would apply to almost any non-Christian person who doesn't recognize Christ as the Messiah. Now, therefore, Antichrist is a different term or a different concept than the beast. And neither of them are used in the Bible to speak of an individual man. Now, there is, in 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, a reference to the man of lawlessness, the son of perdition. And many people understand that to be a future Antichrist and a future individual. And they say, well, that's the beast. Although I'm not sure that we'd have any reason to say that it is. There's nothing about the man of lawlessness in 2 Thessalonians 2 that specifically identifies it with the beast of Revelation 13. But many people think that that is so. Now, when did the papacy begin to be viewed as the Antichrist? Well, even before the papacy arose, the early church fathers, see, the papacy arose, we might say, in the 5th and 6th and 7th centuries. It was a gradual procedure that the bishops of Rome began to take on more and more power and more prestige until around 600 A.D., Pope Gregory is thought to be maybe the first actual pope, and the papacy perhaps begins there, around 600 A.D. But in the 2nd and 3rd and 4th centuries A.D., so long before there was a papacy, the church fathers who spoke about the man of sin, that is the man of lawlessness in 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, they said that that man of lawlessness would rise when the Roman Empire would fall. There's at least, maybe 6 or 8 of the church fathers, if not more, who actually expressed this opinion. In fact, there's no other opinion about the man of lawlessness expressed in the church fathers at all. It was a unanimous view, as near as we can tell, of the early church, that when the Roman Empire would fall, the man of sin would rise. Well, of course, these fathers were writing and living before the fall of the Roman Empire. Therefore, they never saw the rise of what they considered to be the man of sin. However, after Rome fell and the papacy arose in its place as the power in Europe, it wasn't very long before some people, especially when they began to see the corruption of the papacy, began to identify the papacy with the beast or with the man of lawlessness or with the little horn, Daniel chapter 7. And this view was held even before the Reformation. It was held by the Franciscan order, which was Roman Catholic, of course. It was held by John Huss. It was held by John Wycliffe. These men were before the Reformation, 100 or more years before the Reformation. And it was also held by all the reformers, Luther, Calvin, Zwingli, John Knox. All the reformers believed that the papacy was the man of lawlessness. And they said it is because when the Roman Empire fell, the man of lawlessness was to rise. They agreed with the church fathers about that. The difference is that the church fathers had given this interpretation before the event, before the fall of Rome. And the reformers, and some before the reformers, even before the Reformation, saw the papacy as fitting that description. So sometime in the Middle Ages, I don't know who the first person was to make that identification, but it was at least a few hundred years before the Reformation, some people began to see the papacy as the Antichrist.
My question to that is, I don't know if that's wrong or right, or I was raised a Catholic, but I read the Bible for myself and I left the Catholic faith. My question is, there's nothing in the Word of God that says that the man of sin or lawlessness would arise right after the Roman Empire fell, is there?
It's not stated directly. The reason the church fathers thought that was the case was that they saw in Daniel chapter 7 that there would be the fourth beast, which was the Roman Empire, that it would be destroyed and its body would be given to the burning flame. And then there's this little horn that grew out of the fourth beast that would apparently continue to blaspheme and to persecute the saints and do things like that.
Oh,
and
yeah.
So they figured this little horn would rise on the fall of the Roman Empire. That is when the fourth beast was destroyed. And then they believed that Paul, when he spoke about the man of sin or the man of lawlessness, that he was referring to the little horn of Daniel 7.
I see.
And when Paul said to the Thessalonians, Paul said, you know what it is. You know what's preventing the rise of this man of sin. And when that is taken out of the way, then the man of sin will rise. Paul didn't say specifically what it was that was hindering, but the church fathers all believed that Paul was referring to the Roman Empire, that the presence of the Roman Empire was preventing the rise of the man of lawlessness. But they said when the Roman Empire is taken out of the way, then the man of lawlessness will rise. And they believed that was why Paul was so obscure about it. Remember when Paul says, you know what it is that hinders him. Paul didn't say what it is, but he didn't want to put anything in writing that could be used against him to say he was advocating the destruction of the Roman Empire. So he was vague on the subject, they said. Anyway, that's a view that was widely held, essentially universally held, among both the early fathers and also the reformers. The idea of an individual man of sin, an individual Antichrist, came up in the late 16th century from a Jesuit named Francisco Rivera. But we're out of time. We can't search that out right now. We've got the weekend coming up. We can talk more about these things on Monday if you'd like to call back. You've been listening to The Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg, and we are live Monday through Friday from 2 to 3 in the afternoon. We're a listener-supported ministry, and we pay for the radio time a lot of money, thousands and thousands, actually tens of thousands a month. And all of that has to come from listeners. If you'd like to help us stay on the air, you can write to The Narrow Path, P.O. Box 3633, Santa Cruz, California, 95063. Or you can go to our website. There's a PayPal link there. The website is thenarrowpath.com. If you don't want to donate, but you want to take some of the resources, there's hundreds of resources. They're all free at the website. You should check them out. They're of great value. The website, again, is thenarrowpath.com. Thanks for joining us. Have a great weekend, and may God bless you.